This is the Talking Split Podcast.
Welcome, coaches, to the Talking Split Podcast. I am Rob Calder, the Coach Development Coordinator at Basketball Victoria. With me, the man that Tina Turner was singing about, simply the best, Darren Best. Welcome to the podcast, Bestie.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you.
You know we're on the second last episode of the year when you get a little bit of a rev up in the intros. And the woman that DJ Cool was singing about, let me clear my throat, the high-performance coach for the country women, Zoe Carr. Welcome, Zoe.
That's great work from you. Well done. Thank you for having me.
That's why we had to get Besties one in first. We can't have one song intro and not the other song intro. So you are sounding a little bit hoarse, obviously. So you have just landed back in the country from Guam, so we thought we'd bring you to a fairly similar climate, which is the Gage Room.
Yes, it does feel similar.
It's
a little less moisture in the air, but well, yeah.
I did allude to the fact, just won the gold medal as head coach of the Sapphires in the Oceanias. What was the experience like over there?
It was incredible. It's really interesting. One of my assistant coaches, Renee Camino, or Renee Gallup now, who was an Opal, made a comment about you'll never forget the first time you represent your country. And whilst, I was on staff earlier this year as an assistant, we say it constantly on this show, there's a big difference between the assistant seat and the head coach seat, and to have that responsibility, to have the, opportunity and all those sort of things to be able to lead those young girls in their first international experience was just, yeah, it is something I'll never forget. It was the people over there were fantastic. The tournament was ran really well, and yeah, it just all fell into place and it was wonderful.
Excellent. So was it what you thought it was going to be as head coach?
Yeah, it was. People that know me know I always go in with a fairly
cynical.
Yes, for try to account for everything, and be pleasantly surprised. But no, it was. I think, to be completely honest, I had so many people, and I think they were trying to do me a favor by saying that it was going to be, it's Oceania, you're going to be fine, you're going to win every game by X amount, you're going to do this, you're going to do that. And I understand where they were coming from, but that didn't help the nerves. That it was, in fairness, probably made it worse because that expectation also then sits on with everything else. So, we did win games by big margins and, so we had to change what became important, and our standards and our habits became a really big focus for us. And I was sent there was a photo that was posted in a timeout where I obviously didn't look too happy. Another coach sent it to me saying, Zoe, you're up 50, what's your problem? And my problem was we'd let our standards slip. And so they're the sort of things that, we wanted to make sure that we made these standards become their habits, so when they get to the next level and you can't afford to have those little lapses and take the foot off the gas, they're ready and it becomes a full 40 minutes for them.
Yep, and a couple of Victorian athletes in your team, obviously, but you only travel with 11 for the tournament, just with injuries and those types of things and just not enough time to replace people.
Yeah.
Which does make it a little bit harder, but also easier because you can get more minutes into more kids.
Yeah, better rotations.
Exactly,
yeah.
Right. Bestie, we had a number of the Victorian contingent go on the men's side. Did you get to see much of them play?
Yeah, I watched quite a few of the games. I watched some of the girls' games as well.
Oh, thanks, Bestie.
I was there for you. So, from a Metro boys standpoint, we had Harry Beauchamp, Ryder Cheeseman, Henry Sewell and Ned Bramall make the group, which was great. And then from a country perspective, there was Dash Daniels and Lockie Kaisinger. So six boys, which was good.
I mean, it'd be remiss of us not to congratulate Ash Arnott too on jagging the win in the final. A little bit closer than yours, obviously, Zoe. But that was a tense one down the stretch.
That New Zealand team was tough. No, they had some real ballers and really well coached. And yeah, that was a really good game to watch. I know Ash probably doesn't appreciate that, but that was a really good game to watch. And I just want to give a quick shout out as well while we're talking about Victorians to Amelia Dakic as well, who was originally selected in the group. And unfortunately sustained an ACL injury, but is back on the road to recovery now. So I'm sure she'll bounce back bigger and better than ever.
He's hoping, because obviously Asia Cup is next year, I'm going to assume, at some stage.
At some stage, yep.
Yeah, at some stage next year. So it'll be interesting to see how all that goes. And yes, I'm tipping Ash would probably prefer the margin you guys had than the margin that he had in that final.
But it was really good to watch. It was really good, a really good chess match to watch as well from a coach perspective of, you know, one makes a change, here comes their sort of counter and all those sort of things. And it wasn't until right down the stretch that it really broke open. It made for a really good game. And obviously, you know, watching the Haka is always pretty special as well. It's just, you know, gives you goosebumps. Gives me goosebumps nearly every time I watch it. Even I've seen it a million times, but just love it.
Yep. And obviously a number of Victorian athletes and Australian athletes playing for other countries. A couple for New Zealand and for Samoa as well. So fantastic representation across the board. It's just nice to have these tournaments back.
Yes.
In all honesty, and playing again, it's to have athletes be able to represent their country, doesn't matter the age or the tournament, it's always something pretty special to have Australia on your top.
Absolutely.
So it's a great thing.
And, you know, my KFC inside the stadium is pretty special too.
So we're bringing back the important nuggets, literally.
Time out brought to you by Twister.
Yeah.
We are in the mailbag, so we asked for questions from the listeners, and you guys have all delivered, so it's fantastic to be able to go through. And just a reminder, Ash no longer works here, so stop emailing us saying you don't like Ash. Ironically enough, the people seem to have the surname Arnott, so family members actually emailing in about Ash and saying, not a fan. But I don't think that'll be a massive surprise to him in that space either. One of the questions we did have that came through on Twitter, what would you focus on for an 8 or 9 year old athlete that is wanting to enter the rep program? So obviously their child's probably playing domestic at this stage. What are the things that they would be looking to do over the next, say, what are we at, 8 months away from trials now? What would they be doing to try and make sure that they're ready and wanting to enter the rep program?
For me, the only things I would be focusing on are functional movement, left and right hand dribbling, left and right hand layup sort of shot, and shot technique. Obviously, there's a lot more that goes into basketball, but I think the functional movement one is huge. We don't spend enough time on it. And whilst it might not, those things might not get them into a first team, their first year into rep, that's the foundation that sets them up for the future, for making, you know, those first teams, making state teams and beyond. As they get older, when it kind of starts to matter, you know, we need to, I don't think team selection or team numbers really should matter in under 12s as they enter that space. I think it's about getting them into the game, getting them those basic fundamentals and those basic skill sets, and get them moving and figuring out how to run, start, stop, jump, land, change direction, you know, all those sort of things as quickly as possible.
Yep. Bestie, what about you?
Yeah, pardon me. Yeah, you bang on. I think, you know, all the basic stuff that can be done, pivot, pass, dribble, you know, those things, obviously working on your body like Zoe said, but if that's a space that you want to get into, take them out to watch some games.
Yep.
You know, I think that's important. Get out, watch some games, maybe connect with your association that you're thinking of joining. Do they have a rep ready type thing leading up to the trials? Maybe you can see when that starts. Yeah, but bang on, Zoe.
Yeah, and a big part of it too is just making sure they actually want to do it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like it's, you know, we see it a lot that parents are like, my child has to be playing representative basketball now. Do they? Like, you know, does your child actually want to play, or are they just playing because you want them to play in that space? So making sure they don't, and look, we know 8 and 9 year old kids, like their moods and their influences change like the wind. Like it's, you know, they just because they want to play on the Tuesday doesn't mean they want to play on the Wednesday. So It's making sure they do actually love the game, like making sure they're doing it for the right reasons. The functional movement stuff, without question. Like how many coordinated under 12 kids do we see? You know, maybe 5 in a whole program. Like they're all still unco at that stage. They trip over stuff that you wouldn't anticipate them tripping over. But getting involved with your association, like I love the idea of go down and have a look at it and just see if they actually want to do it. Like throw them in the car and drive them halfway across the other side of the state and see what sort of mood they're in at the end of that thing to know, is this something we want to go through you know, in 12 months' time.
Well, and parents have to be sure because they're the ones that are going to do that driving. So, you know, the last thing you want to be doing is having to take your child to a 1 or 2 hour trip away on a Friday night and have them not really want to be there.
Yeah,
so it is really important that for the parents to know as well what they're getting into.
And getting the kid used to doing some work in their own time is a really important thing too. Like even if it's just like a little shooting chart or something that you can put together to say, look, on Mondays I'm going to go and take 20 free hour shots. On Tuesdays I'm going to take 30 right and 30 left-hand layups, those types of things. Getting in the habit of actually putting in the extra work, because that's really what representative basketball should be. It's the additional stuff, not just the, you know, we're trying to win games on a Friday.
That's all before breakfast, right?
It is all before breakfast. Right. Yeah, I'm big on the morning training sessions. I'm a big believer in those, but it's a tough space. Would that change as they get older? So just say, for example, they're a 14-year-old. They haven't played any representative basketball before and they want to go to trials next year. Is there more that you would change?
I think you've probably got to start adding more into it because obviously the game starts to change. Obviously, shooting, ball handling. I think functional movement should stay pretty much all the way through. You know, all the stuff that, Jared Hillier does with his zero step stuff. If you take the ball out of it, that sort of stuff with the jumping and landing on single leg and push off on single leg and all those sort of things, I think. Yeah, rather without focusing on the layup as such, more the have it in as a movement pattern. I think that can go all the way through. I think once you probably hit 14s, now you start needing to add a defensive element to it. You need to start adding, you know, the pass and the catch, particularly the left and right hand passes. You know, rather than just the old stock standard chest pass, which isn't dead from the game, but they need to be able to pass single-handed. So as they get older, yeah, it probably starts to get a little bit more advanced.
Yep. Anything else, Bestie, for like the older kids that are jumping in for the first time?
Yeah, I think typically they would be playing domestic basketball and maybe someone on their team is already playing rep basketball. Find some time to set aside to play some consistent one-on-one with them.
Yep.
Would be good.
I really like that a lot. That's a really good one. And it is, I mean, you've got to go into those trials too, knowing that not everyone takes every player that turns up to those trials. So there is a level of managing expectations too. Like you've got to understand and probably expect that there will be, I want to say favoritism because it's not the right word, but there is probably a preference to kids that are already within that program. So if you're coming in at, say, under 14s, under 16s, you know, you might be the 25th best child, but they've already got 20 kids that have been in their program for 2 years. You know, they're going to get preference. In most cases. So you do have to manage the expectations. Will they make a team? Will they make the team I want? Will they miss out altogether? Are there opportunities to potentially go and be a trainer in that space as well? Because I know there are a number of associations that are looking to add in extra players because we all know what players are like. You know, sometimes they turn up, regularly they don't. So you end up with six at training. There will be some associations that are saying, well, look, you're welcome to come down, train with whichever team, get some extra reps and be involved in it in that space as well. I don't think it's a bad thing. All right, so both of you have gone through your playing career. Bestie did announce his retirement last week. But what is the biggest change you have seen from an X's and O's perspective from when you played to what it is now?
At the risk of I'm sitting in the gaze room.
Yeah, right over your shoulder.
Every time Bestie walks in, he gives a quick little salute.
Yeah. The biggest thing is more conceptual-based offences. You know, I talk to our coaches in NF and say, man, I would have loved to have been given some of this freedom of choice and creativity. So that's probably the biggest one for me. More positionless, you know, it's for a term, and just more the players making the reads and the decisions as opposed to set offences. That's the biggest change for me.
Yep. What about you, Zoe?
100% agree. It's I remember when I was a player, it was A to B, B to C, C to D to get to E, and this is what we're looking for. One thing I will say though from that time that was good, and I think we need to find a blend, is, you know, when the chips are down and we need a particular score, you need an action within your motion that you know is going to get the ball in the hands of the person that you need it to be in where they need it. Because that's what that sort of offense, that sort of terminal offense did bring. You know, it did get the ball in the hands of the person that you wanted for the shot that they wanted. And sometimes I think under a bit of emotion base, you can get caught in a positionless, you know, equal opportunity. You can get caught, you know, not having that real clear focus of your best scorer being able to, you know, do what they do best.
Yep. And I think that's a really good point, Zoe, because those, that older style of play actually fostered role players a lot better than what the current style does, because everyone feels it's their time to go all the time. Whereas if you know you're an important pass part of a process, you're happy just doing that pass and going to set that screen.
Yeah, and I suppose it's the specialisation versus the generalisation as a player within a group as well. Like, what position do you play in the shuffle, Bestie?
I flip-flop between the four and the feeder.
Yep.
Yep.
So we've seen so many great kids be feeders that are just phenomenal passers. They read the game exceptionally well, but they sometimes they're only good at that. Mm. And so they're great for that role in particular, exactly what you're talking about. Fantastic role player, understands what they need to do in that position, but you take them out of that and can they go and play for someone else? Not all the time. So it is a very niche area as well when you look at, you know, what's going to suit the athlete, what's going to suit the team, because there's a big part of me. Like, I look at a lot of the teams and there are some teams that I would suggest are a little bit old school in how they run things. They are some terminal sets, but they're very structured and rigid in what they do, and they do it very well. And their teams are still successful. Like, yeah. It doesn't mean they can't be good. Like, it's just a different style, I suppose, more than anything else. So it is a difficult one. But, yeah, it does change a little bit. Like, you guys weren't dealing with, like, zipper cuts and ghost screens and or anything like that when it sort of came through. I feel like every 2 to 3 years, the style changes a little bit to what's coming next. Like Princeton sort of came back for a little while there. Shuffle probably came back about a decade ago as well. Like, it does cycle through fairly regularly, but just some of the action type things I think are going to be a little bit different. What about defensively? Anything changed from when you played?
Yeah, used to be able to play it.
Just a general broadside to every athlete that's potentially listening.
I'm tired. Yeah. No, it was... And when I say this, I do say it as a bit flippantly, because the athletes that you used to have to defend were nowhere near as quick, as big, as long... You know, so, you know, there's two sides to it.
True. You had 6'1" centres. And we're not dealing with
exactly.
6'1" centres.
You know,
anymore.
So at a whopping 180 centimetres, I was a 4, right? So bit of a, you know, got to keep it in perspective. So it was full court, sustained pressure for a long period of time. It was, you know, in the lanes, you know, hard-nosed denial defense. And, you know, but it was also you really structured rotations when anybody did get beaten. There was, you know, you go to here, you go to here, you go to here. And again, probably could have got away with that because of the level of athlete or the type of athlete you're up against now. Then, sorry. Now, obviously, that's a little bit different because...
It's more of a work it out.
You have to work it out. You know, people are able to make passes now that because of the freedom and the creativity that they've been given, now it's not drive here, pass there. Now it's if they drive here, it could go anywhere. So you've got to find the quickest way to cover the most amount of threats on that penetration. So I think... from that perspective, that's the biggest change for me is the and obviously the addition when you start to get internationally of the zero step or gather step, whatever you want to call it. Guarding that is a nightmare, an absolute nightmare. So you've got super quick, super agile already, and then they're allowed to basically take a couple steps before they put the ball to the floor. So figuring out how to navigate that is difficult, which we didn't have to bother with back in the day. It was all that real strict fundamental footwork.
Keep the ball in front.
Keep the ball in front. And, yep. you know, once they've caught it, if they've put it to the floor, you're fine. You know, all that sort of stuff. But yeah, I think, you know, finding a way to be able to match pace with, I guess, the offense now is becoming more and more difficult as the athletes get quicker and quicker.
Do you think that's a thing, Bestie? Has the offense evolved quicker than the defense has, tactically?
Well, probably. However, just building on what Zoe said, my first thoughts went to the amount of switching.
Yep.
You know, that was there's definitely more of that. And there's also more ball screens and handoff action than what there used to be. But the biggest thing for me is what shots your defense was designed to allow has changed. You know, that's probably the biggest thing. Going back, you'd probably be happy with all but maybe one person shooting threes, you know, whereas now it's you want to sort of force them into those contested mid-ranges, you know, whereas that was considered not contested but a mid-range shot largely was a good shot, you know. So the way your defense is structured around the types of shots you're trying to force a defense into as a team has changed.
Yep, that makes sense. This is probably both your worlds in a lot of ways. So what would you put into an athlete's individual performance plan? So if you were designing something for an athlete that, you know, they want to improve in various areas, what are some of the areas you would hit on, Bestie, to sort of track this along the way? How big would it be? Like, what would you be putting in?
How long's a piece of string?
Yep.
Good question, well intended. However, I think it's important to you've got to know the individual and the level that they're at and what is the next step for them. So you need to have an eye for the short term and then an eye for the long term. The best thing to do is probably break it into some categories maybe. So maybe it's like a ball handling focus, it's a shooting focus, it's a passing focus, and then maybe some similar things defensively and maybe something on the mental side. But yeah, I think for our NPP athletes, it's very specific. We give some film study on certain players that we think maybe they could turn into or something like that. But it's all the most important thing with an IPP is I like the SMART acronym for goal setting.
Yep.
You know what I mean? So is it specific? Is it measurable? Is it achievable? Isn't it reasonable? Mm-hmm. You know, and is it timely?
Yep.
So, and you've got to review those. Yeah. So it's one thing to set it, but when are you going to come back and review it? So the biggest thing, you know, if you're not in a high performance space, I don't know if an IPP is really applicable yep. or even appropriate, depending on the age. But start simple and give them a few categories and one thing in each category. Don't go overloading them. You know, much the same as when we talk about trying to help someone's shooting technique. Simple plan.
And would you allow player input into that IPP or are you dictating as a coach?
We do. Well, I do with the MPP athletes. So, because one of the things we think is important is self-awareness
yep.
of where they're at. So, typically what I do with the IPPs is I send them to the athletes. They fill them out. Then I create a version of it, which I think is maybe a little bit more realistic. And then we sit down and have a meeting around it. So yep. that's the way I go about it. I don't know how you go about it with your athletes, Zoe.
Yeah, I probably should let them have input. But no, I am similar to you, though, in the sense of keeping it simple. I said I do think one of the things that's really important to put into an IPP, often we'll go into them about, and it's all about the weakness, so what they need to be better at. Always carve out time for what they're good at. We've got to spend time making their good great and their great elite because at the end of the day, whilst we want to improve weakness, it's the elite skill set that's going to get them further. So if they're good at something, sometimes we tend to just set that aside because they're already good at it. But we want to make it great, so then we can make it elite. So then that starts to turn some heads and, you know, they can start making teams or, you know, getting offers and things like that. I think that's something that's really important when putting these things together.
And there's got to be, and you mentioned the goal sort of stuff, there's got to be some check-ins along the way. Mm. Like it can't just be a cool, now you've got your IPP catcher and we're out of here. Like it's, and I don't think there's anything wrong with doing a really scaled back version of this for your athletes. And it might just be as simple as, look, what are three things you want to get better at? Like, and okay, if you want to be a better shooter, better athlete, better ball handler, no worries. Here are some, and we talk about like the daily vitamin type stuff. Okay, well, here are some things that you can do along the way over this 12-month period to try and improve that. It doesn't need to be War and Peace in written format or anything like that. I think the interaction between them, great, no problem. But you do have to keep it relative as well. Like if you have your point guard saying, you know, I really want to be a good low post scorer, it's like, mate, you're probably going to get to 5'5". Mm. Don't worry about that. That's probably not your world. So you do have to keep them in check with it, but you've got to make sure that it is going to progress them too. Because I think the real crux of this is, how do you get them better for the long term? Mm. And that's what it kind of relates back to.
Well, we have our kids come in, particularly on the Mondays, pardon me, when they shoot, they have to write a goal for the session next to their name. They've got photos and all that stuff on the board. And I check in with them throughout the session, particularly when it's something that I agree with, you know, what they've put down as their goal. It's like, well, hang on, you said that your shot release speed needed to be quicker and I'm watching you now. It's not. Yep. You know, and then check it. And then last night at the end of the session in our guards workout, we went through one by one because we only had a small group. We had, I think, seven kids on the floor and we said, right, this was your goal. How'd you go with it? What did you do to work on it? How do you need to get better?
Yep.
How do you need to improve it? How are you going to reflect on it in your journal?
Yep. No, I really like that. I mean, we've seen coaches that are like under 12 coaches have their players sign contracts and parents sign contracts and all that sort of stuff. You know, unless it's like Nike or something like that, or New Balance, as the case may be in Basketball Victoria world, be a little careful signing your life away on those things. You may owe them a car at the end of the season. But
don't sign anything.
Yeah, exactly right. Like, I cannot stress enough, do not sign anything unless it has been checked off by someone higher up the road in that space. But you do have to be careful with the IPPs that you're not overloading athletes too, because they may get this big bunch of information and just be stressed out because of it.
Yes. And I think from an athlete perspective, it's similar to feedback. We often get requests for feedback and so we'll give it, and then say 3 months later we get another request for feedback. It's like, hold on, you haven't dealt with the feedback you've originally. Go fix that first. Yep. And then we'll move on. And I think sometimes the hardest part in IPPs is leaving them, you know, leaving them to what they are, because, you know, things are going to – skill sets, athletes are going to develop at different times. So one section of your IPP might be fine and they've got it and you're happy to move on, so you can advance that. But some of it may have to stay exactly where it is.
Yeah, and to that, I've got one of my NPP athletes. He's fantastic and we'll finish the session and I'll be driving home. My phone will go ding. And there's the email. Hi, Darren. Hope you're having a good night.
Saw you. In the 20 minutes.
Sorry, 20 minutes ago.
Yeah. I've got two red lights on Springvale Road so far, so that's about as bad as we've got.
Have you got some feedback for me for my journal? Which is great. Mm. Love it. And for those athletes, that's the relationship that we have with them. However, I don't often elaborate too much on what I'd said the week before, because we go in 6 weeks. Blocks and we've given some goals, you know, keep working on this, little bit of improvement there, so let's, you know, but it's not throw out last week's thing and give you something new.
Well, as well as on top of that, it sounds like we're whinging about kids asking, but we're certainly not. But there's also any session, and this is something I say to my girls often, any session you are getting live feedback in any session. So as soon as that session ends, you need to be writing down that live feedback into your journal, and that is your feedback. So, you know, I think sometimes we kind of go along in the session and, you know, we do what we do and whatever. It's got to be active listening and active learning. And a part of that is taking that feedback within the session and writing it down.
Well, and yeah, and like I said, I'm very grateful to have those athletes contact me for it. And the biggest thing is just sometimes giving them some reassurance that this is still right, and you're tracking the right way.
Yep.
Yeah, especially if it's a section that's taking a while.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, we all know that the generation of today want everything yesterday, and it can become difficult for them to accept that you know, this isn't going to be fixed in a week. You know, we're going to have to hold, and that, and it's important that they know that you're there with them for that, even if it is going to take some time.
Yep.
I like that a lot. All right, so this is probably a little bit in your wheelhouse after what you've gone through the last week. How do you manage blowout margins? Like, and I'd say this without any disrespect, this is the question is what it is. They were talking about grading in particular, mm-hmm. Being on the right end of it when you're up by 50, what yeah. can you actually do? But also when you're down by 50, how do you keep your kids motivated, engaged, and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, so over the last week, that was really tough. One game in particular, you know, we were up an absurd amount yep. at halftime, and midway through the second quarter, I was trying to send a message out to, you know, if we can, let's get to second and third side in our offense, because we were just steal, score, steal, score, steal, score. Rather than that, let's, you know, take some time off the clock, you know, all yep. that sort of stuff. It just wasn't getting through, and I didn't want to call a timeout because that's just as seen to be disrespectful. So we made it to halftime. We're up, yeah, and none of it felt comfortable. None of it felt good to me. We spoke in the change room about let's get through it. You know, obviously, if you're right out on the break, don't just stop, because that's obviously
just as disrespectful.
Yeah. But let's, you know, rebound. Let's get a clean outlet. Let's get our lanes running, and let's then get into our offense and go from there. And to the girls' credit, they were outstanding at it. You know, it's
And they don't do it from a disrespectful perspective. No.
Like they're just competitors. Yeah, they exactly. just want. Yeah.
They're in that uniform for a reason.
Yeah. So that was an adjustment we made. Of, you know, obviously pulling back our defense was critical. Working on different things defensively. You know, we're able to work on the three-way switch a little bit more, and all those sort of things. But yeah, from an offensive perspective, just sort of slowing it down and getting through our stuff, which took time off the clock. Now, we still put, again, an obscene amount of points on the board, but it just took a little longer. So I am a really big believer of work hard, play hard. You're in a competition, do what you can. But there is absolutely nothing wrong with allowing a team to keep their dignity. And thankfully, I was still worried about it at the end of the game, because, you know, the end margin was nothing I'd ever experienced before. But the girls from the other team ran straight up to our girls. They had a photo together. The coaching staff came up and were just so lovely and wanting to have conversations. And I think part of that stemmed from they knew we probably could have won by but instead saw what we tried to do, so and were respect, you know, thankful for that. So that was great. But really, really big. And it also comes down to your behavior, you know, as the coach, that's on you. So we were up by so much, I wanted to sit down, but that's not how I coach in the clutch. I'm up and down the sideline. So if I'm up and down the sideline and then I go sit down, what message am I sending to my players? What message am I sending to the opposition? I need to coach that the way I would normally coach. Similar, you know, the girls would do some amazing stuff, and on the bench they'd start to get a little bit
sort of giggly
over, yeah. And that's on me to crack that back in the line. And to the girls' credit, it only took one. And then once that was done, they were right on board. And it was this actually similar in the final, probably the last minute or so, and they started to get, and I was like, hey, game's not done here. And they were good. And then as it got to, you know, I think about 20 seconds or so, and one of them said, like, are we allowed to celebrate? I'm like, of course, once the buzzer's done. I felt so bad when that question came through. But
you're a horrible person.
I am. I'm terrible. No. But I would take that any day
yeah.
than having an opposition feel disrespected and have my players be looked at as, we've all sat in the crowd and gone, oh, you've got to be kidding, you know, like with the way, with the behaviours that you can see. So, yeah, that's a really long-winded answer, I guess. Grading is obviously a little bit different. You know, you want to win by margins and things like that. But I think if you're talking Friday nights, the grading map kind of sorts itself. You know, you've got enough opportunity to finish where, you know, where you're supposed to land. I think it takes real epic, you know, blow-ups for that to not happen. So I think if you just go by those sort of rules of, you know, allow teams that, you know, work hard, play hard, go to win, do all that sort of stuff. But if you allow teams to keep their dignity, consistently show respect and just always have that feeling of what would it be like if you were sitting in the opposite side, how would you want to be treated? 100% just go with that.
Okay, so if you are on the opposite side then, Bestie, how are you dealing with that? If you're down by the big margin, not that I'm suggesting you've been down by big margins in your coaching career.
Cop that, Bestie.
Yeah.
If you are.
Just before I talk about that, just going on that, if you're up, use that time to tinker with some lineup stuff. You know, play some players that maybe don't play much. Try some people in different positions, that stuff. So if you are down, you got to try to find a way to remove the scoreboard, set different goals. That's the nuts and bolts of it, really. Can you find ways to define success other than the scoreboard? Is it getting your shape on the floor correctly? Is it maybe forcing them into tough shots for a couple of possessions? Those types of things. That's what you got to find, and hopefully that. It aligns with what you're trying to achieve for the season anyway, most likely, as opposed to just trying to do something just for that game.
Yep, and a lot of that, especially if you're down, will be on you as the coach. Like if you just spit it and go and sit down or walk off or start chewing kids out, well, what do you expect the outcome to be in that space? So the importance of being positive in that space and trying to reassure and help and those types of things, I think is really important there as well. Okay, a little bit left of centre. Other sports. So what can we take from other sports that can help with basketball? So there's obviously a multitude of things out there in sport land in general. What sports are doing something that we can take, or what skill sets do we see in other sports that actually help our athletes play basketball? Bestie.
So, right. I think the biggest thing that we could do that other sports are doing that would help our athletes is once they make a level, the level below them drops off. Yep. So obviously there's this conception there around some, I guess if we call them contact sports, you know, you probably can't play three games of AFL in a week, but also, you know, the way the game is played now, basketball at an elite level, it's really taxing to play two or three games as well. You know, the people that are doing that are professionals. They've got serious strength and conditioning behind them. They've got medical and physio support staff with them.
They're not going to school
constantly
all day. Like they're not.
and you know, even talking from a college standpoint, the load is lightened a little bit with your education through those times. And once again, you've got resources thrown at you with recovery and all of that. So that would be the biggest thing that, as a sport, we could learn that as you move up, you know, something needs to drop off. You just can't keep adding. But as far as tangible skills go, we as a sport align fairly closely with soccer, with some of the teaching methods regarding small-sided games and those types of things, yeah. Yep.
Zoe, what about you?
From a skill set, I'd say soccer is phenomenal for footwork, agility, lateral movement, all those sort of things.
Even the tactical, like the space, like playing in, you know, what's coming next.
Or playing in no space. I know that, you know, a soccer field is massive and, you know, all that sort of stuff. But at the end of the day, there feels like there's no space when it's even one-on-one, you know.
There's 11 people on a soccer team.
Yeah.
So whilst there's more space, there's more people.
So So that's massive. I'm actually really big on young athletes doing things like little athletics. I think that's huge for, you know, I've already spoken about it today, but for their movement and things like that. But just being able to get a wide range of sort of different experiences, but also working different parts of their body, all those sort of things, I think are huge. I also think, maybe a bit left of center, things like ballet and dance, even for boys, I it's stuck with me for, I don't know, it would be
no,
over.
No, I'm going to say here, James Heard.
Yes, for over 20 years, I heard, it would have been actually maybe even more than that. And I heard in an interview he did while he was playing, so I don't know how long ago that could have been, but back when I actually used to be somewhat invested in AFL, but they spoke to him about, like, how are you so nimble? How are you able to keep your feet and so strong through your core and all that sort of stuff? And he did ballet as a young child, and he attributes it all to that. And that just stuck with me, of those sort of things that might seem a little out there, but when you really think about it, you go, of course that would be great for what we do, you know. And
it ties in with your functional movement stuff. Yeah. And there are tons of things, like, if you don't want to do ballet, gymnastics, like,
yeah, it doesn't have to be ninja space,
like all that sort of stuff, like the, you know, at the risk of going full office, parkour, that's what I'm thinking. Like, it's, you know, that is something that can actually help our kids move around a little bit more.
It does have to be hardcore parkour too. If you do
hardcore parkour. Yeah. Love it.
That's going to be a drop. Like, it's, but it is. I think that is so valid to our kids, because just the ability to move around without getting injured, knowing how to land without potentially, you know, doing an ACL or breaking an ankle or something like that, because they know how to fall properly. That sort of stuff, I think, is actually really valid. Like, when you look at the AFL perspective, okay, probably the toughness side of things, learning how to take a hit, those types of things, I think would translate across the basketball to a degree. But I think probably the soccer space, I'm absolutely an advocate for. Like, I think that is a massive one in particular. But also, like, exactly what you're talking about, Zoe, that functional movement side of things.
Well, at martial arts,
yeah,
you know, definitely. Like your judos, your jiu-jitsus, those sort of things, you know, and they're a different kind. And for me, if you see yourself as a high-performance basketball athlete, personal opinion, this is just me, I'm certainly not saying that young athletes should,
from his bestie, 'cause this could be anything.
Should be doing this. I'm not saying they should be doing this. What I'm saying is, this is what I would be doing if I had my time again as a high-performance basketball athlete. I wouldn't be adding another contact sport to my schedule. I would be adding something like a martial arts, which is, I understand, is contact, but it's a different kind of contact. It's not a, you know, a high impact up and down, running, you know, all that sort of stuff. You're not doing time trials. You're not doing any of that. It's more physical contact, you know, or like we've said, dance, that sort of stuff. Those sort of things would be the things I would add to my schedule, to be able to complement what I want to do as a high-performance basketball athlete.
Yep. All right. And I get this question at every coaching course I go to, and I get it regularly on the email of people just looking for it. Rebounding drills, bestie. Valid, pointless, what's your best one? Yeah, there's a bit in that.
Yeah. Rebounding drills are rubbish, I'll say it.
Ooh. Here we go. I like these ones.
Yikes.
I'll say it because teach the technique. I think that's important. So teach the technique. But you need to just prioritize rebounding within your practice. So maybe it's – I know for my youth league team, and funnily enough, I've told this story before about having an athlete miss a block out at a national championships and then give up a foul for an N1. And when I went back to watch the film, the athlete was on the baseline doing the three slides. Did I tell that story here? Right.
Yeah,
so, and my staff actually messaged me after that episode saying, oh yeah, remember that. So even at this point, my youth league group at the moment, who I'd coached many of them through 18s, they know miss block out, three slides straight away. So that is probably the best way, as opposed to throwing the ball off the backboard and having somebody just crash into your back. you know, and try and teach that. So technique is important. Selling them the story on why rebounding is important, you know, the importance of it, and then prioritizing it through your regular gameplay, because athletes don't often block out more than twice a possession, I would say. Like, even that would be
possession. They're probably coach said they're saying twice a game.
Yeah, that's probably overinflated. But the best drill I saw to teach technique was actually from Mick Downer, and he taught three different blockouts. The first one was, if you're in front of the rim and you're around that charge circle and the defense is behind you, it's about getting low and driving back. The second one is blocking out from the foul line blockout. So if you're doing that, maybe how to drive up and away. And then the best one that I saw him do was, if we're looking down the court, you're on the right-hand seam in help position, and it's a long shot from the other wing to run to your player to block them out, not to just turn and chase the ball. So that's some technique stuff that we sort of rep through FDP up there. And then it was, hey, this is that one when we spoke about it. But the whole, you know, two lines at the top.
Jungle ball.
You know, that stuff. I don't know. You can budget your time a little bit better, I think. But you've got to be able to sell the story.
Yep.
It's important. And then, like anything, what are you trying to get out of your practice and how are you grading it? So it could be the first two X amount of offensive rebounds wins, for example.
Makes sense. Zoe, what about you?
Definitely don't disagree. I think there is a place on the girls' side for the jungle ball, but more so for a...
When you say jungle ball, what are you talking about?
That drill that Bessie was just explaining, the two lines, you throw the ball off the backboard, two come in and they, you know, battle it out. But that is more from a competitive perspective, trying to drive comfort with physicality, comfort with, you know, having to work their butt off, you know, and repeated efforts and that sort of stuff. Not so much the technique of boxing out. So if you've got an athlete that sort of steps back and doesn't, you throw them into there and, you know,
the choice.
Yeah, gives them, yeah. That's more where I would see that drill sit. But, yeah, completely agree with prioritizing it within your gameplay. I think one of the things that I use is just a little three-word hit, find, get. So you've got to hit your player, find the ball, and then go get it. One of the big ones issues I see with athletes is when their player is sort of semi under the basket or semi under the backboard and they don't know what, like,
how do I
box them out? Yep. And it's that drive them out to the baseline. Like, away from the basket is what we're looking for here. So if they are in that, you know, sort of behind the backboard sort of area, driving them out, you're not going to get it. It's as simple as that. You're not going to get it, but neither are they. And that's the most important part, as well as just front checking. So if you've been in scramble and you're a guard and you've ended up on a big and shot's gone up, you don't have time to hit and then turn and do any of that. You've got to just do whatever you can to keep them out of the paint. So, you know, just a front check where you face them the whole time and you borderline screen them and keep them out. Now, if the ball if you keep them out, you know, to say the foul line doing that and the ball bounces so long that they still get it because they're bigger than you, I would like to think that any coach is going to be okay with that. So those sort of things I think are really important to teach, and I think sometimes because we have so much to teach, we kind of gloss over it.
Well, it's one of the things I talk about with when we end up in a hustle or a switch in drop defense. So when the guard has to switch onto the big, I tell the guards, you don't have rebounding responsibility. You only have blockout responsibility. Yep. Just drive them out.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I do actually love that animal drill or that war drill or whatever you want to call it. Like, I think I used to run it with like three lines on the baseline, three people in, throw it off the backboard. You have to rebound it, put it back in. Then you get out as the other two are still battling. Someone else from your line comes back in. Oh, but it is. It's a great drill.
It's fun.
It's a competitive drill.
Yeah, but it's a competitive drill. Yeah, it's not a box out drill because you're teaching them to rebound and put back. You're not teaching them to box out of that space. So,
well, the other thing too is a lot of that is only blocking out inside the keyway.
Correct.
Which is what I alluded to earlier. There's different types.
You don't get that.
Yeah, there's different types of blockouts, particularly on the perimeter. You know, it's still, you know, you see it a lot. And the number of fouls that come from it too, when someone challenges a three and then they turn and stick their ass into them.
Yeah.
And don't allow them to land. Yeah. And it's like, you don't block out someone like that from the three. Like, at best, it's a forearm.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know, and you're looking to see if they go, you then adjust. So.
And it's really the shooter that ends up with that rebound. Like, it tends to go long side and it's someone coming in from the other side of the floor because someone hasn't boxed out on that side that it tends to be an issue. So, yeah, rebounding drills, they are good, but keep it as part of your game. Or your rep. So
or a warm-up. We do one sometimes where it's one-on-one. You put the ball on the ground.
Yep.
And it's just about keeping contact and driving them back. And if the offense can get around and touch the ball, we do that more as an active warm-up.
Yep. That's not a bad way to do it either.
Yeah.
I like that. Zoe, what are the things that a coach should bring to every training session? If session plan is not one of these, we're going to have to delete this episode.
Well, I was going to say session plan was going to be number one. Definitely session plan. You can make anything work around that if you forget something. But I would say a whistle. As you could probably tell from my voice at the moment, that comes in handy. Water. Cones are really handy or something to – and again, if you don't have those things, that's okay. You can use, you know, the kids' rollers or – drink bottles, but just make sure they're done up. So you can always find a way around that. Depending on the level that you're coaching, you may need to bring the basketballs with you. But I would also say always take a whiteboard and a whiteboard marker. If there's an opportunity, if you've got, you know, you do a scrimmage toward the end and there's an opportunity to draw something off the whiteboard, I think it's important that we do that. I don't think we probably spend enough time on teaching that as a skill to our athletes of how to read the whiteboard and then implement and that sort of scenario situation. So I would make sure that that's always there as well.
Yep. Bestie, is there anything she missed?
No, I don't think so.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's pretty much everything.
It's pretty good, yeah.
Yep. So you used to have your go bag that you'd take to training sessions with tennis balls in it, skipping ropes, those types of things.
Yep.
If you want to take those, that's fine. You may want like a reversible set, like the bibs, just in case, you know, you don't have light and dark and those types of things. So, but yeah, other than that, as long as you've got a session plan, you've got cones, I mean, you can kind of make anything work in that space. Bestie, what are your most hated drills that you see at training sessions that you just sit there and go, oh, I don't know.
Why did the biggest smile just come across your face?
Story time.
Hey, here we go.
This was actually last night, and I hope you're listening, Jenny, because she was running her NPP session on one court and I was running mine on the others, and she had all the athletes lined up in front of the backboard. I'm like, here it comes, tip drill, right? It wasn't that. It wasn't that at all. So I actually said to Jenny when I glanced over, oh my goodness, were you about to do the tip drills? She just looked at me like, no. I'm like, oh, that's great. So that one, first of all, don't like that. But the biggest one that I just can't get behind is three-man weave.
Bestie, you're hitting on a good area here. Keep going.
It's abnormal. It's abnormal movement. You know, quite often you don't throw the ball sometimes backwards and you don't often run behind someone. So it's a strange movement. So I don't do that. However, I have seen a European professional team do it, say, to halfway as a physical warm-up, and then when they get to halfway, they go down the other end and work on a concept. So it might be a drag screen or it might be a flare screen or something like that.
Yep.
So in that context, it's maybe okay. And the other one for me is the Tennessee as well. So I think just think about the types of passes you're encouraging. Once again, you're throwing it backwards, which typically doesn't happen. And quite often it's a backcourt violation in those drills. And I don't know if you would ever throw it to, say, your left and then cut to your right and catch and shoot.
Yep.
So those two are probably...
Excellent.
And then alley drill. I can keep going.
Okay.
Yeah. Once again, I think there's a time for technique, but alley drill is, particularly now when we just try to, let me rephrase that, traditional alley drill, where it's drop step, open up, drop step, open up, drop step, open up, because we don't teach that. The only time you try and turn someone is if you're going to trap them in a run and jump.
Yep.
So, but yes, just to clarify, it was not tip drill for Jenny. But when I saw them, because it was it started with a backboard throw, and I was like, oh, here we go. But it was actually not. It was actually quite good. It was a shooting drill, so I liked it. Yeah, I'll probably steal it.
Oh, very much. Props to Jenny on that one. But, I mean, you've hit on a couple there, because I've always had my you don't do any of the four Ts, and mine were three-man weaves, Tennessee, turnouts.
Oh, that was going to be mine.
And Titan shooting. So I'm adding in tip drill, so we now have five.
Yeah.
What else did you have?
Well, turnouts was one of them, or whatever you want to call it. Horseshoe. Yeah, million names for it. Four corner passing.
Yeah, okay.
I'm not a fan of four corner passing.
Yep. That's the one where you like catch from your right,
pass. And pass, and follow, and then you switch it. And then
and the one where they do the little concertina thing where they all come in together. And then they go back out.
And I get it, I suppose, from a warm up, but I just think there's far, far better ways we could be doing it.
It's footy drill.
It just doesn't translate for me into the game. And I think, you know, if we're going to do all that running and things, we could probably do something a little more constructive. But from a they're probably my two massive ones.
Yeah, just don't translate. A little bit of story time on this one. I remember we were at a youth league game and we saw a team try and do four corner passing. Didn't realise they didn't have enough players on the court at the time, so it went poorly to start off with. Then they grabbed the additional players and took them another 45 seconds to work out why it wasn't going well, because they couldn't work out where's the ball, where is the person supposed to be. And eventually they just did layups.
Yeah.
And that probably summed up their night, because then they had the player intros and, you know, like youth league men being what they are, and you're about to experience this again, bestie, like they get the rah-rah going beforehand and, you know, player gets announced out and they all push them and all that sort of stuff. They push one player who face planted. And that summed up the score margin on that night, which was not close. It's like, well, maybe it starts with your warm-up in that space. Yeah. So you do have to be a little careful. Last question. This is loaded, so there may not be a good answer to this one. How do you teach spacing with under 12 athletes?
Oh, goodness.
Yep. I'm happy to go first.
Sure.
We actually... Wow. Okay, so I'll get angry at the YMCA again. We actually had our trials... 1 year at Casey, and I went around with painter's tape and marked outside the three with X's.
Yep.
And even though we were going back the following day, we had to rip it all off and do it all again on 10 courts. Anyway, that's the best thing I've found, is some visual representation and understanding to them that they don't have to shoot it from there. So I think the visual representation using cues like that is probably the best I've found.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, don't disagree. There's also some flat markers that you can buy. They're like cones, but they're flat and they kind of semi-stick to the ground. So they're not rubber as...
or something like that, I think they are.
Yeah.
Dots. Yep.
so they're pretty good. I think when we're teaching that sort of spacing as well, though, it's really important. When they make a cut, it's okay to slow down. I know we talk about, you know, keep the session going and, you know, get them through and all this sort of stuff. And yes, that's very important. I think it's okay, though, in this instance, there's going to be some kids that just don't get it. And when they make a cut, it's okay to stop them. And the language I generally use is, okay, where's your space? And they look around and then find the space of, because the others have filled and replaced. They find their space and they go there. I don't think there's an issue with that as they're learning it, obviously then as it goes. But if you've got that visual representation of that's a spot, it makes it easier to find.
Yeah. So when you're cutting, often when I'm teaching read and react, I guess we'd call it that, is I actually call under the basket the decision box. So I say to the athletes, you cut to the decision box and then you make your decision on where to go. So that sort of leverages off what Zoe's saying. So they get there and make their decision of where to go.
That makes a lot of sense. And you just got to be understanding that it can look however you want it to look at training sessions. They might actually get it, but when the game hits, it's going to be chaos anyway. Yeah. Like that's if you can at least try and allude to the fact that you should be standing here or try and stand there. I'd love to get, like, I love the painter's tape. Like, I know Zep did it with the showcase the first time we ridden it with the under-12s, and it was fantastic. Like, it was not a Bunnings down Wyndham Way that, you know, had painter's tape left. Like, we churned through that stuff pretty quickly because same deal, we had to pull them up overnight. But it was so good for spacing.
Yeah.
Like, I'd love to get to a point where our under-12 competitions, we can have a chat with the coach down the other end and say, look, do you mind if we throw even just the five-out spacing on the floor and you play the game that way, because you can just allude to the fact that that's where you need to be standing.
Yeah.
Well, and a little bit off topic but on topic, if you're a coach that, you know, yells a lot and all that sort of stuff, and you're struggling with that your team is, you know, doesn't do what you want them to do, or, you know, and you find yourself I know when I first started, I found myself getting really frustrated with spending all this time on all this stuff and they're not doing it. That's where you channel your energy to, in talking them through that. If you can get a pass, a cut and a replace and keep your shape, you're doing very well in a game.
It's a minor miracle.
You're doing really well. Yeah. So channel your energy into that of, if you're going to talk a lot, you know, that's where you focus it.
Yeah.
Well, you start with your active warm-up stuff, and everyone knows the line drill. So if someone's on a sideline and you say, run to the baseline, run to the three-point line, run to the foul line. You know, we're talking young, under-10s, under-12 stuff. You can start to incorporate some of those floor spots. Run to a floor spot. You know, so then, like Zoe says, your language from the sideline isn't individual, so it's not like you're saying, Rob, get to the left-hand diag. You know, you might
I'm going to the right short corner.
Yeah, yeah. You might be able to just have a simple cue of floor spots, and that's a reminder for those athletes. Yeah. You know, where are the floor spots? It's been drilled, and then your coaching cue from the sideline can just be floor spots.
Yep.
Yeah.
And it's tough because kids will gravitate towards the ball, and I don't think they do it from a bad mindset or anything like that. I need to have the ball. It's usually because someone's picked their dribble up, so they think, oh, I'll just come closer so they can make the pass.
It's easier. Like, yeah.
You and your defender and the three other players that are also thinking the same thing. So it is bloody hard
under 12s.
Like, I'd love to sit there and say there's an easy answer. I think the spacing side of things and the understanding of where the actual spacing is and why it's important is just such an important part for the athletes.
Give them a score if they get good floor spots and good spacing at practice. Give them a point for that.
Yep. Yeah. Well, had it with the 15's just gone, you know, constantly saying get comfortable living in space, and 100% it's coming from a good place, but it's scary being out there.
Yep, that makes a lot of sense. So that does wrap up mailbag part one. There will be part two next week. We do have some additional questions left over from today that we didn't get all the way through, but this will drop on the Friday. We record on a Tuesday, so if you do have any questions between Friday and Tuesday, shoot them through on the email and we'll get to those as best we possibly can for next week's session. Coaches, thank you very much for jumping in once again. Good luck with your coaching, and we will catch all of you next week. Look, tune in, enjoy the tribe.